Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history.
What you're about to listen to is a show that was recorded in May when I chatted to the guy who runs the writer's block. And there are just a couple of things that I want to point out before the show starts. In the show, we were talking initially about my three videos, those White Tribes of Africa videos, but this guy had only seen two of them. So he'd seen the one about the secret military alliance between the whites, and he'd seen the one about Portugal and NATO and their roles in the fighting in Africa. And I didn't want to discuss the third video too much if he'd not seen it. And the third video is how South Africa and Portugal almost conquered all of Southern Africa. It's really the end game that the whites of Southern Africa could have had. There were also questions from people who were listening to the live show. And then at a point, I told them about Professor Carol Quigley. Professor Quigley is the guy who wrote Tragedy and Hope. And that was many decades ago when I was a baby. And when Quigley wrote it, it freaked out the white right. But later on, in later years, other books were written by Quigley. And a book that was of great interest to me was a book about the evolution of civilization, because Quigley is a very interesting liberal Christian academic. Anyway, I had been going through the book again recently, and when we were talking on the show, I made an interesting point about a quote from Quigley in that book. Now, I've got many problems with Quigley's analysis. I'm not someone who agrees with everything Quigley says. In fact, I am very wary of lots of things that Quigley says, and I am still looking around and assessing it, etc. But there are some things that Quigley has pointed out that are well worth noting. And I was telling them about a quote where Quigley was saying that Western civilization is the greatest thing that's ever occurred on Earth, literally, in human terms. And amazingly enough, the guys who were listening to the show were so fast that they actually found the actual quote. I didn't even know that somebody else had pulled out that particular quote. I just remember reading it, and I was gobsmacked by what he was saying. And it turns out that, indeed, someone else has already pulled out the quote. And so this is the quote on the screen in front of you. And this quote is from his book about the evolution of civilization. Now, there are many issues with that book, and Quigley is also very Christian. Believe it or not, this liberal academic is extremely Christian. And he's the guy who wrote Tragedy and Hope, but he also did write some other stuff. He did expose a little bit of stuff to do with banking and the Rothschilds in part of his writing. But he is a fascinating and strange fellow, this Quigley guy, Professor Quigley. And one of the things about him that I do have a problem with is that Quigley focuses on Western civilization, especially in the time of Christianity. Whereas when I look at our civilization, the Romans are unquestionably the greatest. And there are other things that Quigley does. Quigley brings the Jews into Western civilization and claims that Jews brought things to us as well. There are all sorts of things from Quigley's work that need closer attention. But he is an academic, and he was a serious lecturer for 30 years. and even people like Bill Clinton ended up in his class. Quigley was something of an academic liberal sensation in America, and that was why I was so fascinated by him. So I will speak more about Quigley and various things that Quigley mentions. And there is some stuff of his that is pretty good, really good, that people will not have any problem with. But anyway, the quote that is important, the quote that is the big takeaway, is this one. No culture has ever exceeded Western civilization in power and extent. Our society now covers more than half of the globe, extending in space from Poland to the east of Australia in the west. In the course of this expansion, most of it during the last five centuries, the power of Western civilization has been so great that it has destroyed, almost without thinking of it, hundreds of other societies, including five or six other civilizations. So that was probably the most fabulous quote that you can get out of Quigley's book, out of that particular book. It is really a stunning statement, and it's very accurate. And this is exactly the stuff that I'm seeing in Africa over and over again, is the power of Western civilization. Western civilization is incredible in its power. And when Quigley says that it has destroyed hundreds of societies without even taking notice of it, it's, you know, almost without thinking of it, other societies have collapsed. But Western civilization has also destroyed several other civilizations. The insane power of the European race is very evident in that quote. And I must tell you that when Quigley says that this expansion has taken place in the last 500 years, that is the Renaissance. And that is also a thing that I've looked at, but I must tell you that I think that we as a people are on the path back to a new Roman Empire, that this is where we are going to end up. We're going to have something like the Roman Empire again. And our value system has changed, and our value system is moving back to that kind of thing. So we are not even yet at the peak of the power that our race is capable of having, despite the fact that we are less than 10% of the population of the earth. Our civilization is still number one, and all the rest are no match for us. Hitler's raised these issues when he spoke about the invincible swastika. Ben Carson pointed this out very clearly when he said that if all white people worked together, we would be 10 times as strong as everyone on the planet put together. And here is Quigley coming up. And Quigley is saying something very similar. And yet he is a Christian liberal academic from America. He is not in any way aggressive at all. And yet he tells you that, you know what, Western civilization is incredible. It's beyond imagination. So just keep this particular quote from Quigley in mind, because it's quite a fascinating quote. And it's very accurate. And I will tell you, I've looked at our stuff from top to bottom. And let me tell you, this may be one of the most accurate things Professor Quigley ever said. Don't you believe for one second that Asia, even Asia, which is our biggest competition, don't imagine that even Asia is capable of crushing us. As for everyone else, they aren't even players at all. If the European race could just learn one thing and one thing alone, and that is unity and sticking together, I'm telling you, the possibilities for us are unbelievable. European civilization is the only game in town. Let me tell you, That is where this thing already is, and it's going to become even more potent than that. We've just got to be careful of the people we allow into our civilization and our attitudes. We really have to stick together. If we stick together and defend our civilization, let me tell you, there's nothing that can stop us. The other thing that came out of the show that was very useful and which will be on the screen for the rest of the show is this particular map that Nicholas found, because this is the nicest map I've ever seen that shows the 1960s. It's even got levels of detail that I've never seen before on such a big map. Like in this particular map, you not only see the Union of South Africa, Southwest Africa, Rhodesia, Nyasaland, Mozambique, and Angola, but you also see the time when the Congo was starting to fall apart and when Katanga, which was the southern part of the Congo, was trying to break away. So that is a very unique map. I've never seen a map with this level of detail. This was a really lovely map. So for those people who don't know the geography of Africa, I'm leaving the map on the screen so that you can understand more clearly what I'm talking about. But that is the first time I've seen a full map of Africa with Katanga there, because Katanga was when the Congo was splitting and the Belgians were trying to hang on to a chunk of the Congo. There's some very interesting history from that time, which is well worth revisiting. I will look at some of those things for smaller videos. Anyway, here is the show and we discuss many, many things. So enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. We are streaming live to our DLive, Odyssey, and Telegram channel. I double, triple, and quadruple checked all of them. We are indeed streaming to all of these locations. And our guest tonight is Jan Lamprecht from historyreview.com. Jan, how are you doing tonight?
I'm all right, thanks. Given the events of the last month, like having my U.S. visa revoked and being stopped from boarding a plane a couple of hours before it took off, along with all the other new laws that have come into South Africa, it's not been a pleasant month.
Indeed, and we can actually discuss this. I believe we are going to get a little bit into it. Tonight, Jan has, of course, been persecuted by the South African government, but it appears the American government is getting in on it right now. But before we do that, we do have some crass financial concerns to address. So you want to donate to the show, you want to help the show, because we are raising money on this show to keep it going and to keep it self-sustaining. And we have already raised enough money for the month of May, which means we are moving into the equipment fund. Now, the equipment fund, as regular viewers will know, is the fund I raised so I can purchase new equipment for the show, to purchase, you know, in the event that it becomes necessary, a new computer, maybe boost the production values a little bit. Because streaming, believe it or not, wears out equipment. So all of your donations will go to that. Now, how can you donate to the show? Well, there are three main ways. First one is Entropy. That's entropystream.live/writersblock. Now, you can go to our Entropy page and donate your hard-earned dollars or pounds or euros or whatever other monopoly currencies are out there. But it's going to be in dollars fundamentally on Entropy. And you can ask me questions, you can ask Jan questions, you can post your comments, you can also just give out of the goodness of your heart to keep the lights on here at Writer's Block headquarters. Now, there's also Odyssey. Now, over on Odyssey, what you got to do is you got to type out your comment into the comment box, at which point the dollar sign will become available. You press that, you select the amount, and you send us your, I believe they call them hyper chats over on Odyssey. So that's how you do it. And incidentally, folks, Odyssey is our preferred fundraising platform because just so much less hassle for me to get the money from Odyssey compared to the other platforms. And the final platform is DLive. And over on DLive, you got to first purchase their funky little tokens, you know, the diamonds, the lemons, the ninjas, the ninja guineas. And with donations of diamond and above, which is, I believe, one American dollar, you can also post comments and ask questions. Although, you know, the character limit is 50. So you might as well spring for the ninja guinea over on DLive. And those are all the direct ways in which you can donate to the show. So Entropy, Odyssey, DLive. There's also an indirect way to support the show, and that is to purchase the fine products of our friends and sponsors over at alaskachaga.com. Their delicious fungal teas will keep you going. They certainly keep me going during these two-hour marathons. That is, I hope, audible enough slurp for the marketing department. They've been telling me I should slurp the chaga more often and more loudly. Now, manners kick in, so I can't always, you know, give that very juicy slurp. But alaskachaga.com, go and purchase their products. Phenomenal stuff. You know, I drink it every time I live stream. I drink it off stream, too, because it's fundamentally good for you, and I enjoy it. It's got good taste. It's got that good earthy taste of chaga. But I believe that's enough crass financial concerns for tonight. So, Jan, you've been having some troubles with the law. What have you been up to since last time you were on the show?
Well, I've been trying to behave myself, and it appears that I've got people who are willing to try to spring some traps on me whenever they get a chance. I was merely trying to get to the USA to go and speak at an event and to do some things there. And the last thing I expected was to have my US visa revoked. My previous visa had expired because it was 10 years. It was for 10 years. And I went and I had to get a new passport, new visa, got everything sorted out. My visa was issued to me in the middle of March, and I was due to fly on the 30th of April. And due to the sort of flight arrangements, I had to do a two-stage trip to America. So I had to fly from Johannesburg down to Cape Town, and then I would get on the American plane in Cape Town. And I was supposed to wait there for about 8 hours to get onto the plane. And about an hour before we were due to start checking in, I suddenly get a phone call, but I also get lots of spam and junk phone calls. So I just killed off the phone call. And then I got a phone call from the travel agent that I had that had booked the flight. And the travel agent said, listen, you need to go immediately to counter 31 because the people, the staff from the American airline want to help you. And I thought that's kind of strange, but not too strange because I had said earlier in the day, I'd been making inquiries, what time do I check in and where do I check in? So when I got this at about 4 o'clock, because the plane was due to fly at 8, when I got this at 4 o'clock, I thought to myself, oh, okay, you know, maybe somebody has remembered my query from earlier in the day. So I walked down to counter 31 and I said, listen, I'm Jan Lamprecht and so forth. And the guy there at the counter says, you know, could I have your passport and your ticket? I give him my passport and my ticket. He gives it immediately to another staff member who takes the ticket away. They give me my passport and then they say, your visa has been revoked. The United States government sent an email earlier today saying that your visa has been revoked and we are to prevent you from boarding the plane. Well, I must tell you that this whole thing caught me off guard. I'd never expected anything like this. And I said to them, well, if you got an email, you know, why has my visa been revoked? Can I see the email? And then they said, no. The email went to management. We were just told to do this and this and this. Anyway, the whole thing is that at the end of the day, I had to basically go and hunt for my luggage, which was already heading onto the plane to go to America. Had to get my luggage, had to hunt around and try and find a last minute ticket to get back to Johannesburg. And I got home well after midnight, along with other stuff like you can't get an Uber because the blacks are busy, black taxi drivers are busy fighting with Uber drivers. So if you call an Uber, Uber is too scared to come to the airport. But yeah, when I got home and I'd had some rest, I eventually saw that, yeah, the United States consulate sent me an email, but they sent the email about an hour after the events that had occurred in Cape Town. And they said, yeah, your visa has been revoked. There's been new information and your visa has been revoked. So now I'm busy trying to find out why has my visa been revoked? What's going on here? So that is what I am busy trying to make inquiries into. And by the way, I did reply to the email like 3 weeks ago. And I said to them, you know, what is going on? What has happened? And 3 weeks later, no reply from the U.S. consulate. So now I'm busy phoning around and trying to find out, how am I going to get any further information? So I don't know why it's been revoked. I have some theories, but they're only theories and I don't know more. So I must tell you that that came out of the blue, eh? That one really caught me off guard. And the two other things that are not good in South Africa, by the way, we are now under 30 years of black rule. And we've got our 30th quotes free election, as they call it. So I think in the month of May, they decided to do a whole bunch of stuff because of politics. And so they passed two nasty laws that white people here are not looking forward to. The one is NHI. It's to do with national health. But it's going to be, remember, we're in a country where we're struggling to keep the electricity on. And NHI is basically going to take all healthcare in the whole country, everything, and put it under government control. And that thing is like a communist nightmare from hell. They're expecting doctors will leave the country, lots of nasty stuff. This thing has been fought by doctors and medical organizations and court, etc. It's nasty, nasty. But even worse is the hate crimes bill. The hate crimes bill is basically going to stop all free speech. That thing is so nasty. I'm not going to go into the whole thing. But people have been, I did videos about it. You'll find I put up stuff called hate speech hell on my website a couple of years ago, with all the details of what's coming, with videos about what's coming, with articles about what's coming. This thing is so nasty, you're not going to believe it. People in their normal daily lives are going to find themselves being accused of hate crimes. So you might be at work, you might say something to someone, you could be anywhere and you say something. One of the groups that's been fighting it the hardest, believe it or not, are the Christians, because when a Christian pastor gets on his podium on a Sunday and he starts preaching out of the Bible, he's going to find himself guilty of hate speech. So Christians have been trying to prevent this thing from becoming law. They've been trying to fight it in 101 ways. Well, the nightmare is now here. So this thing is nasty. Every lawyer I've spoken to has said this thing is a nightmare. They've even said to me that I will not be able to function anymore at all. And this thing is a nightmare, like you can't believe. It reads like the Soviet Union. So that's what's happened.
I wanted to speak maybe about your visa being denied, but I believe that this issue of the hate speech law is a lot more important. I know this is a very difficult question, right, for anyone, really. But have you considered relocating so you could continue your work?
All kinds of ideas have been coming up. People have been saying go underground. Others have been talking about leaving the country. We have discussed these things, and there are many issues relating to it. There's no easy answer to this. There's no easy answer.
Yeah, it's never easy, right? People say you should relocate, but you know, when you relocate, you sort of hit the reset button on your entire life. If you have friends, if you have accomplishments, if you have familial accomplishments, you're basically abandoning them. And it's never as easy as people think. And as for the visa thing, I suspect that I myself, on several Western governments' shit lists, unfortunately, I have never been turned away from a border, much less an airport. I mean, this could all change in the future. But, you know, flying is enough of a hassle as is when everything goes right. What you're describing to me is just... sounds like a nightmarish experience, if I'm being completely honest.
Well, if I may just add in there, I don't think I'm on any kind of blacklist for any state, because in 2019, I went to America. It was my second trip to America, and I even went to Canada. And when you look really closely at the wording in that email, they talk about new information arrived. And the strong suspicion is that somebody else, maybe and most likely not even someone in the US government, may have, let's say, submitted something to the US government, to the State Department, and that may be the reason why it's been revoked. It looks like that's what's really going down here. It's, to me, it's very similar to the days long ago when I was on YouTube, because on YouTube used to have a whole department, it must have been a huge department, for legal issues. And when you put your videos on YouTube, then they tell you, they send you a message and they send you an email and they say, we've received a legal complaint about your video from someone, let's say, in Germany or Czechoslovakia or wherever. And believe it or not, I had something like 800 legal complaints over the year and a half or whatever it was that I was on YouTube, and then they totally shut me down. But in that case, you could see that you've got lawyers, somebody's got lawyers, and those lawyers are submitting these legal requests to YouTube, legal requests and maybe threats for lawsuits, etc., to YouTube, and that is what's really going on in the background. So I strongly suspect that there's somebody else, we don't know who, and they must have submitted something to the State Department. That's what I think happened.
Right. So it would seem to be a targeted campaign aimed at preventing you from entering the USA or maybe traveling at all to the Western world. So you must have made some very powerful enemies, Jan, or some at the very least some very committed ones.
Well, I have some I have some powerful enemies, and we've already been in court. This already happened years ago. We spent almost a year in court. Maybe you don't know about it, but it was nasty, nasty.
Right. So, yeah, that's I guess, the part of the job description. It comes with the territory of being in our line of, I wouldn't call it business. In business, you usually make profit. But we are doing something here, and it seems to have some effect because people are trying to stop us. People are trying to block our messages. Speaking of messages, right, we have a message to deliver. We have a yarn to spin. We have a story to tell. We have information to transmit. And the reason I called you, Jan, is because recently you've released a series of videos about the military engagement of a coalition of Western countries in Southern Africa during the, let's call them colonial wars, during the wars of the Global South, you may call them, and the Global Communist Alliance against the white nations of Portugal, of Rhodesia, and of South Africa. These three being, of course, the white nations of Southern Africa, Portugal through its colonies in Angola and Mozambique, Rhodesia, and South Africa being nations in their own right. But apparently, there was a degree of military cooperation between the three nations and certain allies within Europe at the time. So, Mr. Lamprecht, you have the floor.
Okay. Well, as you recall in our last chat, you raised the issue that some of the South Africans you'd been speaking to kind of said to you that, well, you know, South Africa was fine, and then just suddenly, bang, in the 1980s, next thing you know, the whites lose power and the blacks are in power, and it just kind of happens suddenly. And in our last discussion, you may recall, I tried to sketch for you, as best I could, I tried to sketch a more long-term kind of a story of how one thing led to another, maybe over a period of 100 years, and how eventually the whites went down. And that this was not something that happened just in one day, that there was a, let's call it a long-term campaign against the whites of Southern Africa, and particularly against the whites of South Africa, and more specifically the Boers. So what I sketched to you back then was a kind of a high level thing that I was trying to throw together. But in the intervening years, I have been quietly accumulating other information which I didn't tell you on the last show. At that time already, I knew about the alliance, but I didn't talk about it. But I have been gathering stuff, and the amount of stuff that I got became quite a lot, and I decided that I would release all of it in one shot. So there were three particular issues I focused on. The first one had to do with the whites of Southern Africa actually working together. Because even among ourselves, and this was what I was trying to point out in these videos, was that we in Southern Africa have lived here. We've had the Portuguese here, we've had the Rhodesians and the South Africans, and also the Southwest Africans. I never really mentioned the Southwest Africans, but when I say South Africa, I mean South Africa and the Southwest Africans, now known as the Namibians. But You know, all of these
whites... Just to make clear, we are talking about this German population of Southwest Africa, right?
You know what? It's kind of a mix. It's a mix of Germans and Boers that actually live in Namibia. But yes, it was originally German, but it's more of a mix these days. So when you look at our history and all the books that have been written by whites in Rhodesia, by the South Africans, and even the things that the leaders have discussed, you know, interestingly enough, not many of our leaders actually wrote memoirs. There are many of our leaders who never wrote memoirs. But among the more interesting memoirs that do exist is Ian Smith's memoirs from Rhodesia. And then there is Malan, who was in charge of the military in South Africa. But you won't find any memoirs for any of the South African presidents. And yet they are very, very critically important people. So if you go and you look and you read all the military literature from Rhodesia and South Africa, etc., you won't find much mention of the Portuguese. There will be some mention, but not that much. And you definitely won't find mention of any kind of military alliance. There are lots of things you won't find, and you won't really, you'll get a little bit of info about maybe the politics, the high level politics between Rhodesia and South Africa. And mostly it goes something like the Rhodesians were eventually sold down the river by the South Africans, and that was kind of the end. But you won't see much else. And it was in my research that I began to find high-level things that actually existed that show that there was a lot of high-level thinking among the whites in Africa that actually goes back very far. It goes back even to the 1950s, the early 1950s. And I picked this up in bits and pieces as I was digging around, and eventually I started to see a very interesting picture being formed. And nowadays also, I've been trying to find, when I'm doing research and so forth, I have been starting to push the boundaries further back to before I was even born, to try and understand the politics even before I was born, what exactly was going on there. And I've made some very interesting discoveries. There are maybe some smaller videos that will be coming where I'll show you a little bit of stuff that'll give you a much more, let's call it raw input on what those times were really like. But what I was trying to explain in these videos, in the first video, the video about the white military alliance, ALCORA, was that in actual fact, if you look at what happened in Southern Africa, you have to take it within the context of World War II. Because, you know, World War II caused immense, immeasurable, huge damage to Europe. I mean, it shattered Europe from end to end. And with the Germans going down and the Italians going down and European infrastructure being in absolute ruins, you know, Europe was in a huge mess at the end of World War II. And so one of the things that came out of this is that there were whites in Britain, even in the victorious nations like Britain, but also in other parts of Europe, there were whites who were looking at their situation, and they then started looking at Africa. And here were the whites in Africa, small group of whites. In the early 1960s, the total number of whites was about 3 million, or I'm not sure, 3 million or 3.5 million or so. There were about that number of whites sitting in the southern tip of Africa. And they had not been touched by the war. And they had actually been on the side of the Allies as well. But we're not going to go into all those politics. But here they were untouched, like the Americans, in the same way that the Americans were. And things were looking good for them. And you now had whites from Europe and Britain actually deciding to travel to Africa and starting to look at opportunities in Africa. And so Africa, in the 1950s and 1960s, the white population of Africa suddenly got quite a boost as whites from Britain and Europe were actually moving into these various colonies. Plus, you had the Portuguese. The Portuguese were determined to hang on to their empire, mainly to hang on to Angola and Mozambique. So the white population in southern Africa was very small, but suddenly more whites are coming in. And everyone's looking at life in Africa, and life is looking good. It's looking great, actually. So these whites, the numbers of whites are actually increasing in British colonies, in Kenya, in Zambia, etc., Rhodesia, South Africa. And so white power is actually increasing. The tiny group of whites is getting a nice boost in its numbers. And with Germany down and Hitler out of the way, now we've got Russia, the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union, back in 1928 already, was taking the line that they were going to start smashing the European empires. In 1928, they were saying that South Africa must become a black republic. They were saying that in 1928 already. Stalin issued that order. So after World War II, with Europe in a shattered ruins and Europeans basically walking through the rubble and picking up the rubble, the next set of action is actually the Soviet Union moving on and starting to stir up trouble in Asia, in Africa, in South America. And in Africa, they want to grab the southern part of Africa because the Russians have figured out that the southern part of Africa is insanely wealthy. It's insanely rich beyond all imagination. I have mentioned in one of my videos that just the wealth of South Africa as it stands now, the wealth in the ground of South Africa is over $40 trillion. But there is wealth to the north of South Africa all the way up to the middle of Africa. So who knows the exact wealth in the ground in terms of minerals here in Africa? Who knows? It could be 100 trillion. We don't know. You know, all of these
and
things.
We are, of course, talking about Africa, which is bush or veld, you know, whichever way you want to call it. It's not jungle. It's not darkest Africa. It's not Joseph Conrad's Africa. It's downright habitable, you could say. You know, Europeans, we can go in there without special vaccination. There are no horrible exotic diseases like there is in the jungle. So this is a part of Africa which has milder weather, better natural resources, you know, in terms of both mineral wealth and agricultural resources. And with the Cape of Good Hope, it's actually one of the keys that lock up the world as per, you know, classical British maritime geopolitical theory. The other four being Dover, Malacca, Suez, and I forget the last one, but it doesn't really matter.
Gibraltar,
yes. Of course, to that I would add currently Panama and Cape Horn, but yes, the southern half of Africa is by far the better part of Africa to have. I think you can split the entire continent into four general biomes, those being, you know, Sahara, the jungle, the Horn, and Eastern Africa, and the southern part of Africa. and the southern is by far the most attractive part, even when without getting into the composition of the population. But do continue. Now the Soviets are developing this sort of interest in this part of the world.
Yes. So the Soviets have actually been working behind the scenes even before World War II. They were already working behind the scenes to start finding black movements that they can arm and who will become their proxies. They're about to fight a worldwide proxy war, and these non-whites, because it also includes Asians and others, these non-whites are going to be proxies for the Soviet Union. They're going to come, they're going to fight the whites, they're going to smash them, and then they're going to be allied to the Soviet Union. And this is part of the plan of what was called the Comintern, Communist International. The original plan was they were going to have a communist party in every single country in the world. And by the way, you'd be amazed. There literally has been a communist party in every single Western country as well. Even places you wouldn't expect it, like Canada, America, and some of those communist parties still exist even. Anyway, so after World War II, it's now gloves are off. We're into the next fight, but this fight is to smash the empires, the European empires. But believe it or not, and this is where it goes totally wrong for the British, is here are the British who were allied to the Soviet Union during World War II, but the Soviet Union actually has the British Empire at the top of its list of the empires that need to be destroyed. And so off we go. And the British then start running into problems. And by the early 1960s, they've already started fighting wars in Aden, in Malaysia, and in Kenya. And from my analysis, it becomes clear that the British realize, good God, our entire empire is going to rebel against us. And guess who's going to have to fight them? The British. The British in Britain are going to have to fight their entire empire as their entire non-white empire is rising up against them one by one. And so I think the British saw that this thing is going to destroy them. And so they then decided that what they're going to do is they're going to be real nice about it. They're going to run around to everyone in their empire and say, hey, we're going to give you freedom. Here are the keys. You take over the country. And see you at the Commonwealth, and we'll be trading, we'll be doing business. And that's how the British just dumped their whole empire overnight. But with the British dumping their empire, they still controlled maybe a third of Africa. So the whites who live in Africa, I did read once somewhere that people were saying, oh, well, you know, the whites who live in Africa are just a bunch of colonials. They don't really care about the place, and they will happily just, you know, exit Africa. Well, actually, that's not really true, and it's least of all true in South Africa, especially with the Boers, because the Boers have been living in Africa for as long as there have been whites in America. They've been here for hundreds of years. So with the British pulling out and just dumping these countries, you now have the Portuguese, even the Belgians. The Belgians didn't want to give up. The French didn't want to abandon Africa. I don't talk much about the French and the Belgians, but the French and the Belgians also did want to keep their colonies in Africa. The French ended up fighting a hell of a war in Algeria. The Belgians were too few to fight. So what happened to the Belgians is the Belgians were just like swamped overnight, and they just lost the Belgian Congo. But as you moved further down south, the sort of white population density increases as you go further south. So starting with the Portuguese colonies of Mozambique and Angola, you start seeing that there are some whites there, and if they get support from their European homeland, in this case Portugal, they are willing to put up a fight. And then Further down, you had Rhodesia, which was just a British colony. And Rhodesia would have gone along with what the British said they should do. And then further south, you have South Africa. And South Africa is really the superpower. South Africa is where the vast majority, like 90% of the whites of Southern Africa, actually live in South Africa. And much of that population is Boers. So South Africa is in much better shape. It's very wealthy by African standards. It's got a big white population by white African standards. And it's got a lot of high tech that the Portuguese and the Rhodesians don't have. But what happened in terms of these whites was that when the British said that they were pulling out in 1960, when the British came and said, we're getting out, that is when the whites who are in Southern Africa started talking to each other. And in my one video, I mentioned the concept of the white redoubt. We in Africa didn't even know that there was a white redoubt. Okay. We ourselves have never heard about it or read about it, and nobody's told us about it. But we apparently were driving this concept of the white redoubt. Our leaders at the time were quietly talking to each other about all the whites of Southern Africa sticking together and fighting against the blacks. These wars that you're talking about, officially, they are known as the, quote, Liberation Wars of Africa. So anyway, so the part that has been hidden away or forgotten, forgotten, is that the whites of Southern Africa started talking to each other, and a prime driving force in trying to get all whites to work together are the South Africans. And you must understand that when I say South Africans, that in 1948, South Africa was already ruled by Afrikaans people. Basically, the Boers had taken over in 1948 under the political party known as the National Party, and they were responsible for apartheid as well. So you had these Afrikaans-dominated whites of South Africa who were behind apartheid, who were now engaging all other whites in Africa. And actually, it is amazing the kinds of things that they were talking about so long ago. I was stunned to read that in 1950, D.F. Malan, the first of these Afrikaners to now take power under the National Party, that D.F. Malan actually went to the Americans directly, and he said to the Americans, South Africa would like to be a part of NATO. And America turned around and said to him, no, that cannot happen. South Africa can't be allowed into NATO because NATO is a regional alliance. Now, whether that was a genuine response or whether they were just trying to flip off the South Africans, one can debate that. But I was amazed that D.F. Malan had already asked back in 1950, and here are the Americans just flipping him off, okay? But even after that, the South Africans went and they started speaking to the French and the British, and they even had conferences up in other parts of British-controlled territory, trying to bring the French, the British, the Portuguese, everybody together to say, what are we going to do in defense of Africa? How are we going to defend Africa against the Russians and the Chinese? And I was amazed to see that South Africa was the driving force of white unity to try and get whites in Europe to work alongside whites in Africa so that the European presence in Africa can be defended. And I was just amazed by all those things that I discovered. And then
that's what's really amazing to me. That's what's really amazing to me, because you know, you get this politically correct history, which even some people on the quote-unquote right repeat, that, oh, but South Africa sold out the Rhodesians so they could buy themselves 10 more years of power, or 15 more years of power. But here we are, when we actually look under the hood of the state, and we look under the we look beyond the veil of government, that no, South Africa did not in fact sell Rhodesia down the river, but rather South Africa forged the alliance which allowed Rhodesia to hang on for as long as it did. Or am I just reading too much into this
alliance? No. I'm 100% in agreement with you. South Africa was the major player all along, continuously, right throughout this. And I myself was stunned by it. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, that you know, if we look back decades later at all the things that went wrong and so forth, the one group of people you really got to give some credit to, you really got to go and say, you know what? The South African politicians, the South African generals, all their military people, they saw the future. They saw decades ahead of the time, the fight that's coming. And they were trying to head it off, and they were trying to stop it, and they were trying to see to it that people win. The South Africans were willing to go and fight. For the South Africans, they were saying, hey, our border really starts 2,000 kilometers away from South Africa. We are willing to get weaponry to the Portuguese, etc., etc., so that the Portuguese can hold the front line, so that the rest of Southern Africa isn't inundated. You know, I must tell you that when I look at all this, you'll hear me singing praises to the whites of South Africa in the 1950s and 1960s like you can't believe. I was amazed at the forethought, at the lengths they were willing to go to. They were trying to talk to everyone. They were trying to give money. They were willing to give people weapons for free. They went to unbelievable lengths. I really think that one should give the whites of South Africa, especially the Afrikaners, the Boers, the Afrikaners, we really should give them incredible credit for, if you could call it, trying to play the game of racial unity in Africa and trying to save the European presence in Africa. I was amazed by the things that they tried to do and the lengths that they went to. And so in that first video that I did, I also brought in the White Redoubt, which I managed to find the declassified paper from the US State Department from 1962, where the State Department analyzes the situation in Africa, and the State Department is saying, you know, there's this White Redoubt, and this White Redoubt are all these whites that are going to get together, and they're busy forming a military alliance. And the Americans even feared that this military alliance might become viable, and it could maybe even turn into some kind of political alliance. And one of the lines that I read from there that said something interesting was the State Department was saying, oh God, one of the worst things that could possibly happen is that Rhodesia might actually become closer to South Africa. Oh, that would be the worst case scenario. How are we going to stop that? And let me just talk a little bit about the Rhodesian thing, because among the Rhodesians, I have spoken to other Rhodesians. And by the way, in the last year, Colonel John Redfern
Just let me interrupt you for a little while, Jan. Sorry, but remind me, you yourself are Rhodesian. I mean, you are of Afrikaner descent, but you are Rhodesian.
Yes, correct. Right. So I'm Rhodesian and
so you're saying this as a Rhodesian, right? I mean, I remember it from our last show, but I think our audience should know that because you're talking up South Africans so much, the South African-wise, that you are actually a Rhodesian and not South African.
Yes, I'm born in Rhodesia. So I'm born in Rhodesia, but of South African descent. So anyway, okay. So when I speak to Rhodesians and I speak to Rhodesians about the events, I was in touch with a military guy called Colonel John Redfern, who was of Rhodesian military intelligence. He passed away in the last year, but I'd asked him stuff like about, you know, some things, and there were some questions he'd answer and some which he wouldn't answer. But what was nice about Redfern was that Redfern knew Ian Smith personally, and Ian Smith would visit him at his house in Pretoria personally. So Redfern had a lot of knowledge about the stuff going on behind the scenes. And Redfern actually said to me the one day, he said to me that, you know, it's not actually a certainty that Rhodesia would have rebelled against Britain. And that was an interesting thing. And in further research that I've done, I can tell you that that is absolutely true, that Rhodesia, the Rhodesians could have swayed either way. If the Rhodesians had been just under the influence of the British alone, the Rhodesians could easily and might very easily have chosen the liberal route and have actually handed over Rhodesia to the blacks in the 1960s at Britain's request. That was a very viable and, in fact, the most likely outcome. What changed that were two other groups of people. The one was Portugal, and Portugal was run by Salazar. Portugal was run by Salazar, who is said to be a fascist, etc., etc. But Salazar is the guy who ran Portugal for decades, and he was determined for Portugal to hold on to its empire at all costs. So Salazar was one player, one big player, and the other player was South Africa. The South Africans obviously engaged the Rhodesians and told the Rhodesians, we've got your back. If you go against Britain, you will be able to trade through us. We've got a huge trade network. We've got access to ports, etc., etc. So no matter what happens, you can always trade with us and deal with us and so forth. And then in Ian Smith's biography, he talks about his visit to Portugal to Salazar. And by the way, he praises Salazar to high heaven. And by the way, he points out that Salazar had blue eyes like Hitler. And Ian Smith says that everything they tell you about Salazar, that he's a dictator, that he's cruel, blah, 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 all of it's a bunch of crap. He's actually a gentle, civilized, highly intellectual guy, and he's actually a very awesome person. And he even tells how Salazar said to him, look, we the Portuguese, we've got your back. We will deal with you. If Britain tries to do anything against you, you'll be able to trade through us, you know, etc. So what you've got is you've got Ian Smith. Ian Smith is something of a wild character. He's not a long-standing person in Rhodesian politics. He's also pretty young, but he rises up And he starts becoming like the tough guy in Rhodesia. There are other Rhodesian politicians, and I'll do a little video about all of those guys a little bit later. Then you'll get to see who the guys were at the time of the early 1960s. But my research shows clearly that Ian Smith was the tough guy. And Ian Smith then started, you know, when people started talking about, you know, let's stand our ground, let's work together, etc., Ian Smith then started becoming the main guy that was driving that. And he had contact with the Portuguese and he had contact with the South Africans. But I will tell you from my various reading, etc., it becomes obvious that the governments of these countries of South Africa, Rhodesia, the Portuguese, for them to talk to each other and visit each other, it happens all the time. There's a lot of stuff going on between the whites. Not all of it. They don't document every single trip and so forth. But you can see that these people are meeting, they're talking, and they're exchanging information. And these whites are anticipating the stuff. And no doubt the whole topic of Rhodesia comes up, and where it becomes a strategically important thing is you've got Britain. Britain has got various countries south of the Portuguese colonies. One of them is Rhodesia, one of them is Zambia, one of them is Botswana. So Rhodesia,
right? In the interest, right, so the audience can follow us as well. I don't know if you can see it, Jan, but I've put up a political map of Southern Africa. I believe this is in 1960, in the year 1960, so that people can orient themselves in space as we speak about the history. So in orange, right, or dark orange, we have the Union of South Africa and Southwest Africa, what is today called Namibia, which is at the time under South African mandate. Pink would be British Empire possessions. At this point, I believe Zambia and Rhodesia are still together as Rhodesia and Nyasaland. And in green, we have the Portuguese colonies of Angola and Mozambique. And of course, I believe they're called Swaziland and Lesotho today. Those two small pink circles within South Africa, these enclaves within South Africa itself. Am I getting the geography right here?
Yes, it's excellent. Thank you for putting up that excellent map. Very nice map. Right. Yes, then
this
people,
is
then
this
people
is very
can
important.
It.
Yeah, the geography of the place is very important. I always recommend to people when they're thinking about geopolitics, when they're thinking about history. Get a map of the place, of the political map of the place as it was at the time, and of course a relief map, a climate map, so you can think. I grew up with my grandfather's maps. My grandfather had a lot of maps in his house, so I sort of carry them in my head wherever I go. But everyone else, just you have to use maps. I use them too. Also. Sorry for interrupting you, Jan. Do continue.
No, the maps are very important. I really appreciate you actually putting them on so that people can see what I'm talking about. So, yeah, basically the issue with Rhodesia boils down to the fact that the British have got these colonies that are further south of Portugal, of the Portuguese colonies, and the fear of the Portuguese is that if all of these things come under black rule, then it presents more problems for them militarily, because now you could have, let's say, blacks in Rhodesia helping terrorists to get into Mozambique, for example. And so this is where the whole storyline comes up of the importance, especially to the Portuguese, of keeping Rhodesia around. And the South Africans themselves are very keen. The South Africans themselves are very keen to have as many buffer states between South Africa and the blacks who are coming down from the north, because the blacks are going to be coming from Kenya, from the Congo, from all those places, and the South Africans are trying to create a buffer that whites can fight in, and so that they don't have terrorists just popping out from all sorts of angles. And so it becomes clear that the South Africans, with their military alliance and all that kind of stuff and the politics, that these whites eventually are going to the Rhodesians and saying to the Rhodesians, well, you know, why don't you, I don't know exactly who prompted who, so I can't say the South Africans or the Portuguese prompted the Rhodesians to rebel, I don't know. But clearly this kind of discussion was going on, and then the different sides obviously were saying to each other, yeah, you know, let's work together. And that's where this informal alliance starts coming into being. The informal alliance, from what I gathered, was that the whites would work together, but the understanding was that nobody would force their will on the other one. And you can actually pick it up in the diplomacy of the Rhodesians and the South Africans, where Ian Smith says, you know, do you remember, we are independent, you know, you mustn't tell us what to do, kind of thing. But the whites definitely function like this for decades, where they help each other as much as they can without ordering the other one to do this and to do that. So it's like a, let's call it a willing alliance, and they're working together. And this white redoubt definitely exists, and these whites are quietly starting to work together, and they are working together politically, diplomatically, in every way that they can. Like, for example, they share information about what the blacks and the communists are up to. They're helping each other behind the scenes. Later on, when things get really hot, it becomes a thing of starting to get military forces doing things. But this alliance is basically driven by South Africa, but it's not a physically written document until 1970. When the South Africans and the Portuguese actually write it up. And it seems to have been an alliance that was physically run from Pretoria, here in Pretoria, by military people in Pretoria. But Alcora and the White Alliance, most definitely. So the amazing thing is that the whites of Southern Africa were working together to defend, to help each other, and to try to... And also, you know, you'll see it in various of the combat and military stuff that comes out from the military guys. You'll see that, for example, if the Rhodesians run into black communists and they're busy shooting them up, and then they discover, oh, some of these are ANC from South Africa, you know, then the Rhodesians will shoot the ANC and tell the South Africans afterwards, that kind of thing. So the whites politically, militarily, and economically were actually working together all along. But there were times when people asked them openly, you know, do you have a military alliance? And then they would just lie. So the South Africans, there was like one of the South African prime ministers said, you know, good friends don't need an alliance, you know. I think it was Forster who said that. So the whites worked like that, and there was an actual military alliance between the whites. But then the other side of the coin in the second video was the amazing, if in the first video the amazing diplomacy was South Africa, in the second video the amazing diplomacy was Portugal. All the things that the Portuguese managed to do in order to get some kind of support for fighting a lot of wars in a lot of places. They fought in three places in Africa. One of them is a little place called Guinea-Bissau in West Africa, which to me is not that important. The most important are Angola and Mozambique. But, you know, the Portuguese also had a territory in India, and the Indian government actually invaded and seized a chunk of the Portuguese colony in India, you know. So that was quite a shocking event.
Right. This is the city of Goa, actually. And people don't know this, but a lot of the so-called Indian Catholics, like, you know, famously Dinesh D'Souza in the United States, D'Souza is, of course, a Portuguese surname. They come from Goa, right? Goa was actually a major international incident, because then Portugal, I think they called in every favor they were all owed all over the world. They called on their alliance with the United Kingdom, which is the oldest alliance in the world. They called, I think, even on the NATO Charter, and they were ignored. Then the Indians under Nehru simply took Goa with very little resistance.
Yes. The Portuguese were absolutely horrified when they discovered that, you know, the British and the Americans would do nothing. They'd do absolutely nothing. They wouldn't assist the Portuguese at all. In the end, the Portuguese discover that the only real friends that they've got are the South Africans. And what I found astounding were all the things that the Portuguese did in order to work out a alliance in Europe as well. I was amazed to discover that the Portuguese, Salazar's people, are the key people who actually brought West Germany into NATO in the early 1950s. They were the ones putting pressure on NATO to bring in the West Germans. And it is due to Portugal alone that the West Germans became part of NATO. They had their first base outside West Germany in Portuguese territory, etc., etc. And here were the Portuguese. They were talking to the French. They were talking. They even managed to get a little bit of weapons out of the British, amazingly enough. They managed to get weapons out of the Americans, which I thought was quite astounding. And, you know, because the Americans and the British really come out very weak when it comes to dealing with the blacks. There was a guy on Odyssey. I don't really look at the comments much in the videos, but I did spot one comment in the bottom of the one video where it must have been an American, and he said that when he looked at this video, he walks away with the viewpoint that the Americans, given how much enormous power they've got compared to all these little European countries, that the Americans are the big pussies in the room kind of thing. That, you know, here are the Portuguese, the French, the Germans, and other European countries. You know, the Italians and the Spanish also helped in other ways as well, and were always friendly to the whites in Southern Africa. And everybody is busy giving weapons or selling weapons or assisting with the military stuff in Africa. Nobody is worried about what the blacks think. Nobody cares. They are just working, you know, with the other whites. And it was really quite amazing all the different things that the Portuguese managed to pull off, and the amount of weaponry that the Portuguese managed to get, and how Portugal, which was, you know, one of the poorest countries in Europe, was busy building up the biggest military force in Africa of any country. It was even bigger than the military force of South Africa. Their navy was huge compared to the South African navy. The Portuguese were really building up an amazingly impressive army in their absolute determination to hold on to their colonies. So I'll give you a bit of space there if there's anything else you'd like to... Right.
Well, I mean, it's the interesting thing is, of course, that we know from, a bunch of declassified information, which has been declassified for a long time now, so people have no excuse if they don't know this, that the United States at its highest echelons of government had been infiltrated by communists since the 30s, really. A lot of them came in with the Roosevelt administration. A lot of them are, you know, ethnic Jews, but just as many, I would say, are old stock Americans, which is a blotch on that nation's history. But I was going to say, when you were saying before about the really diplomatic mastery of the South Africans, that the alliance which the whites of South Africa managed to pull off, of Rhodesians and Afrikaners and Portuguese and everyone, really all of Europe pitching in to help, with the sad exception of the United Kingdom and America, it could in the future provide a blueprint for an alliance of European nations, really, the kind that we desperately need to beat back the attacks our race is facing. Specifically, because I like this approach of, it's very obvious that South Africa is the first nation of European Africa, of white Africa. It is by no means the boss of Southern Africa. There is no vassal suzerain relationship between South Africa and Rhodesia, for example, right? Ian Smith reminding the South Africans, we are an independent country. We are going to act in a sovereign manner. And that, you know, for me, I support white unity in Europe, but I was always worried about, the sovereignty of small countries, because I come from a small country. I am Macedonian, which is one of the smallest countries of Europe. But we have our pride, we have our sovereignty, we guard it jealously, or we should at any rate. And it was always an issue for me of like, okay, what happens to the small nations in such alliances? And it seems to me like Alcora seems to provide, it just provides an answer to this sort of predicament.
Yes, you know, it actually shows that, you know, the whites could work together so nicely, so quietly. It was all secret, and it was amazing how long it carried on. And it was only towards the end, when things started getting really hard, where you get this sort of, let's call it, whites in breakdown mode. When I look at history that I've read of Europe, like, for example, Napoleon and the French and Hitler and the Germans, you get to that point where a nation starts becoming overwhelmed. And you reach that point where the odds are too much and the nation is physically starting to break down now, and things are going wrong for Napoleon, things are going wrong for Hitler. Now, when a nation goes into breakdown mode, then people are stressed, people are stressed, the system is no longer working how it used to work, your military and your political and economic situation is starting to get overloaded. And now you also start getting people turning tail, running, others becoming traitors, etc. So the thing that I like to think of Rhodesia and South Africa before Rhodesia hit breakdown mode. The breakdown mode only happened in like the last 5 years of the existence of Rhodesia. But prior to that, for the 15 years prior to that, everything was going great guns and everyone was working quietly. And you can see many examples where the sides are working together and where this system is working. For example, I raised the issue that there are specific battles, some of the biggest battles the Rhodesians ever fought in Mozambique after the collapse of the Portuguese, were battles where it is clear that the Rhodesians went to the South Africans, even General Walls personally going to the South Africans and saying, listen, we got a problem here. We really need you. We want to fight these people here. It's critically important for us now, but we just don't have the firepower. Can the South Africans come and, you know, be Big Brother. And to me, it's quite amazing how, you know, all of a sudden you will see in certain operations, suddenly the South Africans are there. They don't have to be there. It's not their fight. It's actually Rhodesia's fight. But there are the South Africans, and they are piling in there. And for me, it's almost a tearjerker to see these different whites fighting together. You know, I find it awesome. Yeah. I find it awesome,
especially because you know, the war in Europe, which is the most brutal brother war in European history, was just so fresh in everyone's memory. Of course, Ian Smith was himself a veteran of that war, got his war wounds in that. You know, for those who don't know, Ian Smith was, I believe, an airplane pilot, a combat pilot who was shot down, and part of his jaw was missing, but it added character to his face. So not 20 years, not 30 years after possibly the most destructive brother war in the history of Europe, here are the whites of Southern Africa helping each other in such a selfless manner. And speaking of selflessness, you know, we do have some donations to read out. People have been donating all evening, and I believe they have questions. So let me just find my list here. We have Spartan Sardukar donating one diamond over on DLive, and he says, "Regrow Hair Fund." Yeah, he's been commenting on my new hairstyle. It seems to be the audience's favorite new hobby, commenting that on the fact that I have shorn my hair. Your jokes are noted, Spartan Sardukar. Yeah, it's actually a good one. It's a good one. You had me chuckling when I read it. We have Clown World Gamer over on Odyssey for 10 American dollars. And thank you for that generous donation, Clown World Gamer. He says, "It's also tragic how the changes in the political landscape of the West in the 60s sealed the fate of whites in Southern Africa for the worse. And now that whites no longer have any holdings ruled by them in Africa, Africa is coming to us. Have some change for the fun next." Thank you for that, Clown World Gamer. And yes, of course, the one leads to the other. See, it was never really about, I mean, decolonization was never really about the blacks wanting freedom. It was the blacks wanting us specifically. They wanted access to white people. They wanted our wealth. And at some level, I think that all whites fundamentally resent us, not because we're wealthy and they're poor, but because we are beautiful and they are ugly. And this may sound silly, but unless you've seen rich non-whites, like rich blacks, rich Arab sheikhs, rich Chinese, and the way they behave around even really poor white people, the sort of resentment, burning, seething resentment that a rich Chinaman or a rich Arab has for, you know, white plumber or just a minimum wage white person, you start to understand that this is not money they're after. It's not status. It's not prestige. And I think it's because of the way we and they look. That's my speculation. I don't know if you agree with that, Jan. It's not something you can readily measure, but it's something that I've really observed.
Yeah, one can have quite a discussion around that thing. All I will say is that from what I can see in the history here is that all these people were keen to get their hands on the wealth and the wondrous things that had been created in Africa. And they thought that when they grabbed it, they thought, if I look now decades later, I must tell you, it is clear from reading what various blacks have said, it is clear that they thought that if they could just get the whites out of power, and hopefully most of the whites would leave Africa, that they would then live happily ever after, that never again would they have any problems. However, if you look at what's transpired in the decades since then, these are things you and I haven't discussed, but I must tell you, for example, the Muslims, There are a lot of Muslims that have been moving into Africa and starting up Muslim movements that are that contain blacks who are fighting other blacks. So nobody talks about the fact that there's a whole bunch of Muslim wars in Africa where black Muslims funded from the Middle East are actually attacking black nations. So they thought, get rid of the white man and life is going to be wonderful thereafter. But they are going to discover some interesting things about the world. And the world is actually a brutal, competitive, nasty place. And they already are struggling with the Muslim issue, but there are many other things that are coming. I've seen comments from blacks where blacks have said, oh, the infrastructure these whites built needs maintenance. Well, and they complain as well, because the infrastructure that they are complaining about is like 50 or 60 years old. And they're like, oh, you know, so you whites built stuff and it didn't actually last forever. So, you know, all kinds of weird things. And I think that a lot of their thinking is starting to fall apart, over and above the fact that inside Africa, and this may be extending to South Africa now, starting with this election, is that the blacks have forgotten that before the white man came, that they were at war with each other. And that when European power came to Africa, it brought them two things that never had before. They'd never had so much progress and development as they had under white colonial rule. And they never had so much peace as they had under colonial rule. Whites stopped all the black-on-black conflicts in Africa. But those conflicts have been starting up over the last 20 or 30 years. So, you know, these blacks don't know it, but they are heading into a world that might not work for them the way that they imagined. But just wanting to discuss the future a little bit, I did enjoy your statement where you called the Boers the first nation of European Africa. The Boers are unquestionably the most important representatives of Europe in Africa. And if you go back, I was actually doing a bit of other research, just reading some older stuff going back to the 1800s. In the 1800s, when the British were working on this thing of overthrowing the Boers in their republics here in South Africa, in the 1800s, the Boers had a lot of diplomacy going with Germany, with France, and with Russia, where they were talking to various Europeans, and those Europeans were going to support the Boers against the British. So, you know, it goes to show again that the Boers have constantly had links to Europe. And when the Boers lost their republics, their president, President Kruger, went into exile in Switzerland, by the way. So, you know, the Boers are like this little group of whites holding on to this chunk of territory in southern Africa, but their sort of prime diplomatic links are back to mainland Europe. And they struggle with the same problems that mainland Europe struggles with, which includes, you know, the fact that Britain and mainland Europe, you know, you've always got the British issue on mainland Europe, but now you've got the British issue in southern Africa. And the British are always operating in a way that is out of step either with the Europeans or with the South Africans, the Boers, or when it came to the whites of Southern Africa as a whole. Truly, one is always disappointed by the British and their behavior in Africa. I see it over and over again. It's like, I think that it is because of the empire. I think the empire and the British trading across the world, I think it's caused them to always fall back on their non-white trading links, and that they throw their toys out the cot and you know, like with Brexit and all that kind of stuff, you know, they give the finger to mainland Europe. And it's unfortunately a thing that I can't see this going away. There's always like a competition, and the British are always taking the other side, and it results in all kinds of problems for Europeans, but also now for the whites in Southern Africa. But regarding the future,
we can't be really too harsh on the British. We have to remember that their state in the late 19th century was, you could say, almost uniquely among the European states, penetrated by a certain ethnic interest at the very highest level. And over on my relatively new website, radicaldose.com, we've been actually publishing a great series about Britain and her Jews. Let's come out and just say it as it is while it's still legal. And just how deep the rot of the British state goes all the way back to the 19th century. Again, the same with with America. If heritage Americans were running America, I have no doubt that Americans would have come to the aid of, the whites in South Africa to assist this fight against early communism and the rising tide of color. But as it happens, you know, America's been run by people like Morgenthau and Alger Hiss for a very long time, and you could say the same thing about the United Kingdom, sadly. So but the British folk themselves, I don't think they can be blamed, although they do have that sort of piratical, you know, if things go badly, we can just hop on a boat and go away mentality, which, you know, the Afrikaners, the Boers, being Dutch descended, it's more, you know, they're well equipped to fight against rising tides. They know how to build dikes. They know how to plan ahead. You mentioned that whole foresight that the South African state and its potentates had in the 50s and the 40s and the 60s. And all I could think of, yes, this is the farmer mindset, the need to look 20, 30, 50 years into the future, right, in order to be a successful farmer. I don't know if a nation which is mercantile in nature can really look that far into the future.
Yeah, you raised some very interesting things, and I'm glad that you raised those other topics. That's excellent. No, I don't have any issue with what you're saying there. I'm glad that you're educating people. Yeah, so you know, whites have got these weird things that are messing us around, but you know, when I look at if we look at the future, there are a couple of things I want to mention. If we look at the future, there are still many possibilities. I do not believe that the future is carved in stone. And when I look at many things, when I look at the things that have been done against whites, I actually want to tell you that a lot of things that have been created that function against white people, and I did, by the way, I did raise this also with regard to the wars, that if the whites in Southern Africa, we never, ever, ever sat and thought, could the Soviet Union collapse? We never thought about that. The Soviet Union just seemed to be so enormous, like America, And the Soviet Union seemed like it was going to be there for the next 500 years. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was actually struggling. And if even the Rhodesians had had a sort of foresight and the kind of viewpoint of, you know what, even if we lose Rhodesia, we're going to fight it out street by street. We'll blow up the bridges. We'll retreat. We'll take our army with us. We'll retreat out of Rhodesia slowly. I've raised this issue before. And I look at it now and I say to myself, you know, if the Rhodesians had said we're fighting forever, if the Portuguese had said we're fighting forever, etc., and everyone had taken a long-term view of the matter, we would actually have turned things around much sooner. The Rhodesians, instead of splitting off and running into the wind in every single direction, Rhodesians could have existed as a group still and could have used South Africa or a chunk of territory between Rhodesia and South Africa as a homeland. I actually did a video about this quite a long time ago where I had some maps and I looked into that possibility. So when I look at it, I say to myself that one of the lessons is that we whites in Africa should have had more confidence in ourselves as a group and taken a longer term stand. The one thing that really screwed everyone was the unexpected coup d'etat inside Portugal. The Portuguese also had internal problems, but the way in which it came out of the blue from a unexpected angle where a Portuguese general or whatever engaged in a coup, that really threw the whole thing. But other than that, that was like the only thing that really went totally wrong that came out of the blue. But other than that, between the Rhodesians and the South Africans, things could have been approached from a much more longer term perspective. And I think that we lost a lot of faith in ourselves, even though we're a small group. If you look at what we achieved, we managed to achieve quite a lot in the face of tremendous odds. But the future, I want to tell you, when I look at the future and I'm constantly sitting and trying to divine the future myself as I watch these various wars that are taking place, etc., I must tell you, I still think that Europe has finally managed to rebuild itself and to start getting up onto a level where it can match America and that kind of thing. So Europe is back in action. And I think that all these things that have been built against us are mostly houses of cards. And lots of these houses of cards might not actually last that long. And, you know, people who think, for example, that the future of Africa is carved in stone, and that the way Africa is today is the way it's going to be in 1,000 years from now. The more I look at Africa, the more, and I sit and think about it from a geopolitical point of view and the future, the more I'm starting to say to myself, you know what? I think there are many, many possibilities. And the other thing as well is from a European perspective, Africa is not of any importance to the Americans. Africa was a place where the Russians were very happy to make buddies, but Africa is far away from Russia. And so the place that is really important, where Africa's sort of... The sphere of influence where Africa really falls into is really Europe. It's Europe all the way. Even now, lots of raw materials are bought by the Europeans from Africa. The natural link is between Africa and Europe. But how can whites make something out of that in the future. I do want to tell you, I think there are many, many possibilities. And I don't think you must write off the Boers. The Boers have got the Boers. And by the way, the Boers are actually like about 50% Dutch, 50% German. They're actually a bit more of a mix. So they're not just totally Dutch. And the Boers are determined to hang on to territory in Africa. And they might have lost political control, but they still very much see South Africa as theirs. In their mindset, they see South Africa as theirs. So they are still around. I think the future could be very interesting if only all whites would work a little bit together, even just gently work together. I think amazing things are possible. And I look at these houses of cards, and I'm saying to myself, how long are these things going to last? Because I'm becoming a skeptic as to how long they will last.
Indeed. And you mentioned the Soviet Union, that it fell after how many years of existing. And when it fell, it became clear to everyone that it was really rotted from the inside all the way back in Stalin's time, really. This was not capable of withstanding the serious pressure that the Reich exerted in 1941. It was bailed out by the Americans and the British to a lesser extent. And it was not serious opposition to the West, not really. These people were enabled and coddled at every step. And the second, someone like Ronald Reagan became president of America and ramped up the pressure slightly, the whole thing keeled over in less than a decade, right? So, and I believe that our current predicament, you could say that it's actually weaker than the Soviets were in 1983. Obviously, we are going to see how these things unfold. And I also want to move on into the final part of this show where, Jan's going to make a very interesting proposal for white people. But before we do that, we have three audience questions to address. The first one is from Insightful World for 1.43 library coin. And good thinking, Insightful World, because I need those library coins to keep the replays of these shows up on Odyssey, one per show. So we have, for Jan, when there was all the rioting in South Africa in 2021, there was a lot of footage from Muslims and whites standing together against the blacks. What is the relationship like between, firstly, whites and Muslims, and secondly, blacks and Muslims in South Africa? Thank you. And I think this relates to the points you made about the black Muslims fighting the black nations in Africa.
The situation between the blacks and the other races is very, very interesting. To understand the Muslim thing in South Africa, what you need to understand is this, that most Muslims in South Africa are mostly Indians. Most Muslims are Indians. Some are coloreds, mixed race. Now, we never talk about the Indians or the coloreds as entities by themselves, but they are also entities in South Africa that can pack a punch. They are almost the same numbers. The coloreds exceed the white population a little bit. But the Muslims, the Indians are slightly less, or quite a bit less than the whites. Now, the interesting thing is that when there was this alliance against the whites under apartheid, everybody was against the whites. But what is now starting to come out is that The coloreds at the moment, I don't see any particular direction for the coloreds that's unique. All I will say is that as the colored numbers grow, the coloreds will become more of a force by themselves, and don't expect them to just do anything the blacks want. But the 2021 riots are very interesting. And I want to return to that myself because I got some very interesting footage from there. In the 2021 riots in Natal, Natal is where there are a lot of Indians / Muslims. And the blacks then actually set out in some cases to go and kill Indians because the Indians are rich. And it's starting to become a thing that the Indians are being targeted, I think. The Indians are coming under a certain amount of stress now because they are being seen as, quotes, rich, because they are actually quite well off and they've been doing very well under black rule. So it's interesting that some of the radical blacks are now targeting the Indians. Well, this is where in the Natal area, when they went after the Indians, turned out that Indians and whites had actually been working together. And the Indians and whites actually stood together against the blacks in certain areas. And also in a total first in South Africa, there were Indians who were armed. And there is actually a massacre that took place there. There was a place where the blacks came in to kill the Indians in the suburb of Phoenix, and then the Indians actually shot a whole bunch of blacks. Then the blacks went and cried about it. So there's some very interesting stuff that happened. And I must tell you that when I look at the politics of South Africa, where everyone used to be against the whites have kept a low profile. But things are changing. And I want to tell you, in this election, keep an eye on Jacob Zuma and the MK party. You are seeing the beginnings of something big on the black side. The blacks are splitting, and the blacks are going to come and are going to have tremendous stress between themselves. This MK party could lead to many things in the future. It might even lead, in the long, long term, it might even lead to the Zulus one day breaking off. But you are seeing the beginnings of very interesting things. And I should add something in. I did produce a third video, which I only put out on Odyssey the other day. And the third video was about what was the white end game, what was the high-level strategy of the whites in Southern Africa in order to finally win. And that was the last video of the three. And I think people will be quite amazed at what comes out of that video.
Well, thank you for that, Jan. Now, let me just flesh out the details for the audience. So as you pointed out, Jacob Zuma is one to watch. Jacob Zuma, of course, former president of South Africa, he's a Zulu, right, of the Zulu tribe, whereas the other presidents post-apartheid, Mandela, Mbeki, and Ramaphosa, they're, I believe all of them are of the Xhosa tribe, which it's a different tribe. I don't really understand the differences, but they do have some historical grievances. I believe that Shaka Zulu at one point massacred the Xhosa very badly. And then there's the coloreds, and then there's the Indians, and then there's the whites, right? So South Africa is not just black versus white. It's a very complex, multi-ethnic environment. And as you said, the anti-white coalition, in the absence of whites, has now begin to fray at the seams. We have another question from Insightful World, and he donates one more library coin. He asks, also for Jan, how likely are the Chinese going to be the new colonizers of Africa? I've heard many stories of Chinese men marrying African women. I don't believe for a second there's any attraction between the two and that China are entrenching themselves. Will there be a resurgence of African communism?
You know what? People keep raising the issue of the Chinese in Africa, and I don't see anything that that indicates to me that the Chinese are going to be that good. I'm, you know, even with this Ukraine war and the threats of China and Taiwan, I've raised the issue a number of times in videos that when I look at the Russians and the Chinese as two great powers, okay, that you're going to be amazed that despite the enormous population of the Chinese, that actually it's the Russians that are the toughest of the two, by far. The Russians are the toughest, and, you know, maybe it's that European blood in them, but the Russians are the toughest. The Russians are the strongest. The Russians are the ones with the most fight. And remember, the Russians and the Chinese were functioning in Africa during these liberation wars, and it was the Russians that were the prime enemy. The Russians came through as the prime ones who were arming the blacks, who were fighting, who were driving this thing forward. So, you know, when I look at the Chinese performance in Africa in that time, it's not impressive. And the Chinese did many things in Africa, and it's not impressive. And they don't have staying power. And I keep telling people that I think that this story of China seizing Taiwan, you will probably not even see that being attempted in your and my lifetime. That these Chinese, the Chinese are, you know, when it comes to a house of cards, the Chinese may be the biggest house of cards out there. I've looked at their military, I've looked at their economics. And they may be communist in name, but I want to tell you, they do not pack the punch of the Russians. And the last war that the Chinese actually fought was against the Vietnamese in 1979. And who are the Vietnamese? They're like a tiny little Asian country, okay? And when the Chinese invaded them, the Vietnamese, with just militia units and stuff, were fighting the Chinese, who had tanks and things. And after 2 months, the Chinese retreated out of Vietnam. I must tell you.
And it has to be said that at the time, Vietnam was devastated from having fought first the French and then the Americans for the better part of 30 years. So this is the Chinese were, of course, they're not a martial people. And even if they were at one point a martial people, they were a land power. We are talking, of course, about the Chinese waging a sea war, a naval war, a naval campaign against Taiwan. And that's just not going to happen. I wrote about this about, I believe it was a year ago, when Nancy Pelosi touched down in Taiwan and everyone was saying, oh, the Chinese are going to invade now. And I said, no, this is insane. This would be behemoth swimming out to sea to meet Leviathan. And the Chinese are not even good at fighting on land. However, I don't think that's going to stop them from trying. I believe that the Chinese political formula depends on reversing the century of humiliation before 2048. Because, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, they seized power in 1948. They gave themselves a century to reverse the previous century of humiliation, as they called it, where they were basically dominated by European powers and the Japanese. And to them, basically, Taiwan is a symbol of continued white dominance of China, even though, you know, Taiwan is its own Asian country. So they have to do it, otherwise they lose legitimacy, they lose the mandate of heaven. The fact that they're going to be shit at it, I don't think it's strong enough to stop them. So I'm going to disagree with you there with the Chinese. I agree that they are a house of cards, but I don't agree that it's not going, that they're not going to attack Taiwan.
Okay, well, we can differ on that, but I will say for my prediction for Africa, the ability of the Taiwanese to project power all the way into Africa in a deep and meaningful way, I don't see that as possible. They got their hands full with Taiwan, which is less than 200 miles or kilometers from their shore. I don't see the Chinese as a big issue in Africa. I've looked, and we have got some Chinese around and so forth. I must tell you, all round, I've looked at them, I've assessed them, and although this topic comes up again and again, I'm a huge skeptic about what they could pull off. I think the whole setup in Africa is not working so well.
Right. So, yeah, the Chinese, they're not, I mean, I guess they could be a civilizational level threat if they are directed by a senior partner, which early on it was the Russians and then it was the Americans, and now it seems to be the Russians again. But on their own, I don't think they're a, they need a spanking, right? Because they're getting a bit too big for their britches. But I agree with you there. The Chinese system is nearing its the end of its shelf life. Now we have a final question from William for $3 American over on Entropy. And he says, oh, it's not a question, it's just a comment. He says, whenever I need encouragement, I just think what Jan Lamprecht would say about Napoleon or Hitler or other white emperors. Jan, you are very encouraging. Everyone should watch his videos. Indeed, everyone should watch Jan's videos.
Thank you very much. And whatever I have to say about these gentlemen, it's real. I don't have to spin them up. They are awesome. And if I may add something a little bit to that, I've been reading a bunch of memoirs, including, I've been especially going through memoirs of lots of the German generals of World War II. And I've been reading some, going through some additional ones. And I've got to tell you, man, that when I look at what the Germans pulled off, and you know what's kind of strange, it may sound strange to you, is that even with Napoleon and with Hitler, you know, the nastiest part of the war to read about is the part where they are losing. You know, I always find myself not wanting to read the parts where they are losing. But in actual fact, every time I've done this, I've discovered that when you actually read what the actual generals on the ground were doing in the final months and weeks and so forth of the war, and you see how those men think and what they come up with, you just walk away in total amazement at in the case of the French in the time of Napoleon and the Germans in the time of Hitler. I just walk away with absolute amazement. These Europeans are so tough and so clever, and you know what, you can throw anything at them and you'd be amazed how many things they pull off in situations that you think are impossible to survive in. So keep watching. When I do more of my Gods of War, you're going to see lots of stuff.
Yeah, so we're going to be watching that space, as people say. Now, the final thing I wanted to discuss with you, Jan, and really just ask you and let you tell our audience is, you are not what is sometimes called an ethno-pluralist. Now, ethno-pluralism is this position that every nation on the planet deserves its own country. Nationalism for everybody, it's sometimes called. You're, of course, of the belief that Europe belongs in Africa, that Europeans belong in Africa, and especially the southern part of Africa should be, at some point in the future, reclaimed by Europe. You know, of course, this can be spearheaded by the Boers, but fundamentally, it will require the efforts of the entire European continent and the entire white race to accomplish. So, can you explain really your position on this from the geopolitical to the moral, if you will?
My view is that you need to look at the world the way it really is. And the world is not driven by morality. It never has been. If you look at the world, you'll see the world is very competitive. And, you know, we Europeans don't even realize how competitive we are, even amongst ourselves. We are actually an incredibly competitive people. And I must tell you that the future, I think when I look at the world the way that the, let's call it the Americans, who are the current power of the world, the Americans have kind of come along and said, oh, we're here to give democracy to everybody. Everybody can have their own place, etc., etc. That's the American vision. But whether that American vision can survive into the future in the face of reality is something that I'm questioning more and more. And when I look at Europe, Europe has got so much power. You know, we forget that, you know, maybe there are 200 million whites sitting in America, but there are 600 million whites sitting in Europe. And I look at the world and I say to myself, how come the people of Europe are just supposed to be crunched in that little piece of space? You know, history shows that people move and that there's competition. And I think that Europeans and Europe can, I think that Europe can and should expand. I'm a big believer that Europe must become the greatest superpower. Because when I look at the way that the Europeans have also behaved compared to the other whites, I must tell you, I think Europe has done many things. And the Europeans have also shown that they have more of a racial loyalty than other whites have. I think I would like to see a super Europe. I really would like to see it. And it can move in many directions. And nobody ever asks, what about the direction of Africa? I think many, many things are possible. And when I look at the technology, the politics, the engineering, etc., the only thing that is wrong with our race is that there's too much nonsense in the politics at the top, that somebody somewhere has been messing around, and our politics is not our politics, in the same way that you said about the British and the Americans, that white people don't really have their true politics. But if we had our true politics in the lines of like Hitler, etc., I think all kinds of impossible things would become possible. And when I look at the actual strength of our civilization, you know, I'm reading another book. I've been going through another book by a guy called Professor Quigley. And Quigley is an American liberal Christian. But
Carol Quigley.
Yes, Carol Quigley. But you know what? Even in his book, at a point in his book, he says, I can't remember the exact quote, but it goes something like this, that you know what? Even if you have your own opinion, and, you know, you are like nationalist and you're always in favor of yourself, the one thing you cannot get away from is the awesomeness of Western power. I'm saying this in my own words because I don't have his actual quote in front of me. But he points out, he says Western power is so tremendous. And he even talks about how the Western world's power is so tremendous that it crushes other societies without even realizing it. It's actually a fantastic quote. I will, when I put out more Quigley stuff, I'll find that quote so that you can hear it the way he says it. But even Quigley turns around and says, you know what? Western power is the most awesome thing in the world. There's nothing that matches it.
People in chat are wondering which Quigley book you are quoting there.
The Quigley book that I'm quoting is a book that people don't know much about. It's called The Evolution of Civilization. And those who want to read it, I urge you to read it. I went after that book because of its historical stuff. I don't agree with everything in it. There's lots of stuff in there that I question, lots of things I don't agree with. But it's of his books, it's the one that's probably the best. And that book is the book that sort of gave him a big name in academia in America. And that is his most important work, actually. So it has some interesting concepts in it, and it's well worth going through. Just keep in mind, he's a Christian, he's a liberal, he's soft in the head in many places, but there are some interesting concepts in there. There are some interesting concepts in there, and I will be pulling out some of them because some of them may be of use for us in analysis. So, Evolution of Civilization.
I've heard some other thinkers, you know, also rely on Professor Quigley. Of course, they quoted Tragedy and Hope, which may be his most famous book. My verdict on Quigley is I have to start reading him myself because he shows up too many times in nationalist discourse for me to keep ignoring him, I guess. But that's very interesting. And you are right that we have these sort of wrong politics. So, for example, you know, with the whole Ukraine war, with the Russia-Ukraine war, people were saying in the beginning, oh, Europe is just going to run out of resources without Russia, which, you know, Europe is a resource-poor continent, relatively speaking. And nobody thought of the idea of, well, Europe should defeat Russia and appropriate those resources. Well, you know, one man, a former Austrian painter, may have thought about that idea, but in the modern era, you have America and Germany and whatever fretting about provoking Russia when it turns out that the Russians aren't as tough as they present themselves, that even, you know, Ukraine with some backing can hold them at bay. You imagine what a united Europe could do to them, and we can just waltz into Siberia and take those resources for Europe. I believe it would be even simpler to appropriate Africa's resources for Europe. I've said before that Europe's southern border is not, you know, in Italy or Greece. It's in Libya and Algeria and Egypt. We have to control those coasts if we are going to control the movement of population into Europe, right? And when I say control, I mean stop. Even in the Americas, you know, Trump was always saying build a wall, but the proper move, it appears to me, is to just invade Mexico and bring order to that chaotic land and, of course, prevent all crossings from Mexico into America whilst appropriating Mexico's resources for America. So we have been under this, and, you know, I'm guilty of perpetuating this in the past, that we need to turtle down in our nations and not move anywhere. But it seems to me like the best defense is a good offense in these cases. And we need to start thinking offensively as Europeans. We need to start thinking about ways to expand, about directions to expand. You know, Europe can move into the south and into the east. We can, America, you know, combined North America, Canada, and USA can move into Mexico and further into South America. And of course, the whites of South Africa should expand northwards. We should, at the very least, put the enemy as in that old Rhodesian song, you know, north of the Zambezi till that river's running dry. But we are limited by defensive thinking. We are limited by this thinking of if we respect their rights, they're going to respect ours, because, you know, the lion's not going to eat you because you don't eat the lion. I'm afraid history doesn't work like that.
You raised a bunch of interesting things there about Hitler and the Russians, Hitler's analysis about the Russians. All of his analyses were correct, eh? And if it wasn't for America, mainly America, actually, the Germans had this thing sewed up, okay? And it wasn't like, oh, Hitler, you know, they always like to portray Hitler as some kind of fool. You know, oh, Hitler the idiot, the moron, Napoleon the fool, you know, everyone's an idiot. No. Hitler actually did it real well. And the Germans easily could have had a chunk of territory that would have been astounding. You know, if the Third Reich had existed, you know, it would today probably have been like 10 times as wealthy as the United States, you know. And it's very interesting when you start talking, you know, the geopolitics of Europe. When I was going through various German stuff, you know, topics were starting to come up about the southern part of Europe, North Africa, go and look right back to the Roman Empire, etc. You know, European power around the Mediterranean is a very important thing. You know, I must tell you that the thing that notice where the thinking comes from, notice where the wrong thinking is coming from. It's coming from America. The Americans are constantly looking. You see, the Americans have got their 200 million whites, and they got more territory than they need. Okay, so for them, they got more territory than they need. And so for them to say, oh, well, everybody's just going to stay within their borders, that's all it's got to be, you know, that's great for America, and it's great for Canada, and it's great for Russia, right? But what about the Europeans? And if you look around the world, you'll see all kinds of other people and all kinds of other things that are just sitting there ripe for the plucking. And I must tell you that, you know, I would like to see the world moving in the direction in which it was going before the Russians and the Americans came on the scene and messed it up for Europe, you know, with World War I, World War II, you know, because prior to that, Europeans were rocking. You know, I was talking to a good Dutch supporter of mine the other day, and the Dutch supporter, we were talking about the Dutch having an empire. And this Dutch guy, and he's a mature, middle-aged guy, and he's no fool, okay? And he told me, he and another Dutch guy, I was talking to two of them, they were telling me, you know what, when we went to school, we were never even taught that we had an empire. They didn't even know. That's how they were dumbed down, hey? They didn't even know they had an empire. And they like go and they go onto Wikipedia and what have you, and they're looking and they're like, and there I am pointing and saying to them, oh, yeah, do you realize that, you know, 120 or 150 years ago, you guys, tiny little European nation, okay, you had huge chunks of territory on the opposite side of the world, and you only had sailing ships, and you could go and you could still control those nations literally on the other side of the earth with sailing ships. And you know, look at how whites were crawling all over every inch of the world. And I much prefer the attitude of Europe, really. And notice the Americans. The Americans go, they'll go to they'll go to fight in Iraq. Okay, they're doing all these things for Israel, right? So they're going to all these places, clobbering people, and then they retreat back to America. But you know, look at the Europeans and look at European military thinking and Lebensraum and that kind of thing. Those things have got much more value. Those things have got much more long-term value. Go and conquer a piece of territory, settle it, do it like the Romans did it, do it like whites have done it in the past. That's what works. If you go and you smack someone and then you retreat back home, then you got a never-ending problem. And there's an entire world. There's a world filled with vast possibilities. And you're just saying, oh, well, just, you know, let it go. And I just failed to see that as a way forward for the rest of our race, you know.
Well, I'm going to have to be the guy who defends Americans once again and point out that ethno-pluralism comes from the
understood.
French this
time. Understood.
From the French this time, from Nouvel Droit, the New Right, the French New Right, which, you know, is it authentically French or has it always been a Russian influence op? I don't know. I guess time will tell, but these people have some unsavory connections with Alexander Dugin and the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Agency.
What do they say?
Well, they are the ones that originated the whole ethno-pluralism thing, that every nation has to have its own state, that colonization was always wrong. It was always baked into the cake that these colonies would simply backwash into Europe. And I got to say, I'm guilty of perpetuating this thinking in the past, but I've been evolving more towards what you're describing here, essentially, which is that Europe needs to needs at the very least to control its immediate neighborhood, which is at the very minimum, I would say, the steps up to the Volga River and the northern coast of Africa, the entire coast of the Mediterranean really has to be controlled because that's the de facto border of Europe. And I got to commend Capri Koziol in the Telegram chat. Capri Koziol, one of the brave Poles guarding the eastern borders of Europe, he says, no culture has ever exceeded Western civilizations. He found the full Carol Quigley quote, and it's up on the screen for everyone to see. And let me just read it out. No culture has ever exceeded Western civilization in power and extent. Our society now covers more than half of the globe, extending in space from Poland to the east, from Poland to the east of Australia and the west. In the course of this expansion, most of it during the last five centuries, the power of Western civilization has been so great that it has destroyed, almost without thinking of it, hundreds of other societies, including five or six other civilizations. And that's Professor Carol Quigley, one of the most insightful liberals of the 20th century. And so we have already exceeded the 2 hours that the show was supposed to go on for. But anything you would like to add, Jan, before we conclude, anything you would like to say to people anywhere you want to direct them, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. And that is the exact Carol Quigley quote there. The only thing I'll say to people is keep an eye open for my videos, especially my Gods of War series. And also, if I do follow-ons on what I call the WTA, White Tribes of Africa series, where I will try to fill in a couple of other little bits and pieces for you. And I urge people to watch those three videos that I did. The first one about the secret military alliance, the second one about the Portugal and NATO's secret wars in Africa, and then the white endgame. What was it that the white leaders of Africa concluded would be the solution to the problem? And some of the stuff that you've been discussing today, if you watch the third video, you'll be in for a surprise. You'll see exactly what the whites were thinking. And I must tell you that if all white people just thought racially, our civilization is unbelievable. And speaking from an African perspective, where I've had a chance to look at everyone else, I must tell you that most whites out there in the world don't grasp the awesomeness of where you come from.
They say humility is the surest sign of greatness. And, you know, you listen to the blacks, they beat their chests, they puff their chests out, and they're the best. You listen to the Chinese and you'll hear that China number one, but white people have a humility, which I believe it adds to our greatness, right? We're simply not satisfied with what we've already built. We got to keep building more. We got to keep conquering more. And that's probably the fire in the belly that everyone talks about. But it's going to have to end now. We are going to have to end the show now. So this has been the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey, and tonight's guest was Jan Lamprecht. We were discussing the past and future of Europe in Africa, not just Europeans in Africa, but Europe in Africa. I do believe there is a future for Europe in Africa. I want to thank Jan for appearing with us tonight and sharing with us his hard-earned wisdom, his very great insights and historical perspective. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live and everyone listening to the replay. We do these shows for you. We do these shows so that you may become better white nationalists. You can refine your methods and we can ultimately win this thing, because I like winning. You know that. I want to thank everyone who commented in the regular chat. You may have noticed I rely on the regular chat to keep the conversation going. And of course, you bring me information, which is very valuable. That's also highly appreciated. And I also want to thank everyone who donated. Your donations are what keeps the show going and allows me to sort of keep it self-sustaining, because otherwise I would have to pay out of pocket. Speaking of donations, we have a last-minute donation from Board Troll for one lemon over on DLive. And finally, I would like to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Gaius Maximus, Reed Johnson, and Bartleby, for keeping the various chats safe and for keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant information. Thank you, guys. I really would not be able to do this without you. And yeah, this has been the Writer's Block. Bye-bye, people, and take care.
Give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight, every game you play, you will reach the top. At the top, that is where you will stay.